In 1922, the New League of Nations issued its mandate for Palestine, which formalized Britain's governance of the country. In an extraordinary gift to the Zionist movement, the mandate not only incorporated the text of the Balfour Declaration verbatim, it substantially amplified the declaration's commitments. The document begins with a reference to Article 22 of the Covenant of the League of Nations, which states that for certain communities, their existence as independent nations can be provisionally recognized. It continues by giving an international pledge to uphold the provisions of the Balfour Declaration. The clear implication of this sequence is that only one people in Palestine is to be recognized with national rights, the Jewish people. This was in contradistinction to every other Middle Eastern mandated territory, where Article 22 of the Covenant applied to the entire population and was ultimately meant to allow for some form of independence of these countries. In the third paragraph of the mandate's preamble, the Jewish people, and only the Jewish people, are described as having a historic connection to Palestine. In the eyes of the drafters, the entire 2,000-year-old built environment of the country with its villages, shrines, castles, mosques, churches, and monuments dating to the Ottoman, Mamluk, Ayyubid, Crusader, Abbasid, Umayyad, Byzantine, and earlier periods, belonged to no people at all, or only to amorphous religious groups. There were people there, certainly, but they had no history or collective existence, and could therefore be ignored. The roots of what the Israeli sociologist Baruch Kimmerling called the politicide of the Palestinian people are on full display in the mandate's preamble. The surest way to eradicate a people's right to their land is to deny their historical connection to it. Nowhere in the subsequent 28 articles of the mandate is there any reference to the Palestinians as a people with national or political rights. Indeed, as in the Balfour Declaration, the words Arab and Palestinian do not appear. The only protections envisaged for the great majority of Palestine's population involved personal and religious rights and preservation of the status quo at sacred sites. On the other hand, the mandate laid out the key means for establishing and expanding the national home for the Jewish people, which, according to its drafters, the Zionist movement was not creating, but reconstituting. 7 of the mandate's 28 articles are devoted to the privileges and facilities to be extended to the Zionist movement to implement the national home policy. The others deal with administrative and diplomatic matters, and the longest article treats the question of antiquities. The Zionist movement, in its embodiment in Palestine as the Jewish agency, was explicitly designated as the official representative of the country's Jewish population. Although before the mass immigration of committed European Zionists, the Jewish community comprised mainly either religious or Mizrahi Jews, who in the main were not Zionists, or who even opposed Zionism. Of course, no such official representative was designated for the unnamed Arab majority. Article 2 of the mandate provided for self-governing institutions. However, the context makes clear that this applied only to the Yishuv, as the Jewish population of Palestine was called, while the Palestinian majority was consistently denied access to such institutions. Any later concessions offered on matters of representation, such as a British proposal for an Arab agency, were conditional on equal representation for the tiny minority and the large majority, and on Palestinian acceptance of the terms of the mandate, which explicitly nullified their existence. Only the first catch-22 in which the Palestinians would find themselves trapped. Representative institutions for the entire country on a democratic basis and with real power were never on offer, in keeping with Lloyd George's private assurance to Weizmann. For the Palestinian majority would naturally have voted to end the privileged position of the Zionist movement in their country. One of the key provisions of the mandate was Article 4, which gave the Jewish agency quasi-governmental status as a public body with wide-ranging powers in economic and social spheres and the ability to assist and take part in the development of the country as a whole. Beyond making the Jewish agency a partner to the mandatory government, This provision allowed it to acquire international diplomatic status and thereby formally represent Zionist interests before the League of Nations and elsewhere. Such representation was normally an attribute of sovereignty, and the Zionist movement took great advantage of it to bolster its international standing and act as a parastate. Again, no such powers were allowed to the Palestinian majority over the entire 30 years of the mandate, in spite of repeated demands. Article 6 enjoined the mandatory power to facilitate Jewish immigration and encourage close settlement by Jews on the land. A most crucial provision, given the importance of demography and control of land throughout the subsequent century of struggle between Zionism and the Palestinians. This provision was the foundation for significant growth in the Jewish population and the acquisition of strategically located lands that allowed for control of the country's territorial backbone along the coast, in eastern Galilee, and in the great fertile Marj ibn Amr Valley connecting them. Article 7 provided for a nationality law to facilitate the acquisition of Palestinian citizenship by Jews. This same law was used to deny nationality to Palestinians who had emigrated to the Americas during the Ottoman era and now desired to return to their homeland. Thus, Jewish immigrants, irrespective of their origins, could acquire Palestinian nationality, while native Palestinian Arabs who happened to be abroad when the British took over were denied it. Finally, other articles allowed the Jewish agency to take over or establish public works, allowed each community to maintain schools in its own language, which meant Jewish agency control over much of the yeshuv's school system, and made Hebrew an official language of the country. In sum, the mandate essentially allowed for the creation of a Zionist administration, parallel to that of the British Mandatory Government, which was tasked with fostering and supporting it. This parallel body was meant to exercise for one part of the population many of the functions of a sovereign state, including democratic representation and control of education, health, public works, and international diplomacy. To enjoy all the attributes of sovereignty, this entity lacked only military force. That would come in time. To fully appreciate the particularly destructive force of the mandate for Palestinians, it is worth returning to Article 22 of the Covenant of the League of Nations and looking at a confidential memo written by Lord Balfour in September 1919. For areas formerly part of the Ottoman Empire, Article 22, provisionally, recognized their existence as independent nations. The background to this article in relation to the Middle East involved repeated British promises of independence to all the Arabs of the Ottoman domains during World War I, in return for their support against the Ottomans, as well as the self-determination proclaimed by Woodrow Wilson. Indeed, all the other mandated territories in the Middle East ultimately won independence, although both mandatory powers, Britain and France, twisted the rules to maintain the maximum degree of control for the longest possible time. Only the Palestinians were denied these advantages. While representative institutions and progress towards self-rule were obtained by the Jewish population in Palestine, which benefited uniquely from Article 22 of the Covenant. For decades, British officials disingenuously but steadfastly maintained that Palestine had been excluded from wartime promises of Arab independence. However, when relevant extracts from the Hussein McMahon correspondence were revealed for the first time in 1938, the British government was forced to admit that the language used was at the very least ambiguous. As we have seen, one of the officials most deeply involved in depriving Palestinians of their rights was Britain's Foreign Secretary, Lord Arthur Balfour. A diffident, worldly patrician and former Prime Minister and nephew of longtime Tory Prime Minister, Lord Salisbury, he had served for 5 years as Britain's Chief Secretary in Ireland, the empire's oldest colony, where he was much hated, earning the nickname Bloody Balfour. Ironically, it was his government that authored the 1905 Aliens Act, meant primarily to keep destitute Jews fleeing Tsarist pogroms out of Britain. A confirmed cynic, he nevertheless held a few beliefs, one of which was the utility to the British Empire and the moral rightness of Zionism, a cause to which he was enlisted by Chaim Weizmann. In spite of this belief, Balfour was clear-eyed regarding the implications of his government's actions that others preferred to pretend did not exist. In a confidential September 1919 memo, not publicly known until its publication over three decades later, in a collection of documents on the interwar period, Balfour set out for the cabinet his analysis of the complications Britain had created for itself in the Middle East as a result of its conflicting pledges. On the multiple contradictory commitments of the Allies, including those embodied in the Hussein McMahon correspondence, the Sykes-Picot Agreement, and the Covenant of the League of Nations, Balfour was scathing. After summarizing the incoherence of British policy in Syria and Mesopotamia, he bluntly assessed the situation in Palestine. The contradiction between the letter of the covenant and the policy of the Allies is even more flagrant in the case of the independent nation of Palestine than in that of the independent nation of Syria. For in Palestine, we do not propose even to go through the form of consulting the wishes of the present inhabitants of the country. The four great powers are committed to Zionism, and Zionism, be it right or wrong, good or bad, is rooted in age-long traditions, in present needs, in future hopes, of far profounder import than the desires and prejudices of the 700,000 Arabs who now inhabit that ancient land. In my opinion, that is right. What I have never been able to understand is how it can be harmonized with the Declaration, the Covenant, or the instructions to the Commission of Inquiry. I do not think that Zionism will hurt the Arabs, but they will never say they want it. Whatever be the future of Palestine, it is not now an independent nation, nor is it yet on the way to become one. Whatever deference should be paid to the views of those who live there, the powers in their selection of a mandatory do not propose, as I understand the matter, to consult them. In short, so far as Palestine is concerned, the powers have made no statement of fact which is not admittedly wrong, and no declaration of policy which, at least in the letter, they have not always intended to violate. In this brutally frank summary, Balfour set the high-minded, age-long traditions, present needs, and future hopes embodied in Zionism against the mere desires and prejudices of the Arabs in Palestine, who now inhabit that ancient land, implying that its population was no more than transient. Echoing Herzl, Balfour airily claimed that Zionism would not hurt the Arabs, yet had no qualms about recognizing the bad faith and deceit that characterized British and Allied policy in Palestine. But this is of no matter. The remainder of the memo is a bland set of proposals for how to surmount the obstacles created by this tangle of hypocrisy and contradictory commitments. The only two fixed points in Balfour's summary are a concern for British imperial interests and a commitment to provide opportunities for the Zionist movement. His motivations were of a piece with those of most other senior British officials involved in crafting Palestine policy. None of them were as honest about the implications of their actions. What did these contradictory British and Allied pledges and a mandate system tailored to suit the needs of the Zionist project produce for the Arabs of Palestine in the interwar years? The British treated the Palestinians with the same contemptuous condescension they lavished on other subject peoples from Hong Kong to Jamaica. Their officials monopolized the top offices in the mandate government and excluded qualified Arabs. They censored the newspapers, banned political activity when it discomfited them, and generally ran as parsimonious an administration as was possible in light of their commitments. As in Egypt and India, they did little to advance education, since colonial conventional wisdom held that too much of it produced natives who did not know their proper place. First-hand accounts of the period are replete with instances of the racist attitudes of colonial officials to those they considered their inferiors, even if they were dealing with knowledgeable professionals who spoke perfect English. The experience in Palestine was dissimilar to that of most other colonized peoples in this era, in that the mandate brought an influx of foreign settlers whose mission it was to take over the country. During the crucial years from 1917 until 1939, Jewish immigration and the close settlement by Jews on the land, enjoined by the mandate, proceeded apace. The colonies established by the Zionist movement up and down the coast of Palestine and in other fertile and strategic regions served to ensure control of a territorial springboard for the domination and ultimately the conquest of the country, once the demographic, economic, and military balance had shifted sufficiently in favor of the Yishuv. In short order, the Jewish population tripled as a proportion of the total population, growing from a low of about 6% of the whole at the end of World War I to about 18% by 1926. However, in spite of the extraordinary capacity of the Zionist movement to mobilize and invest capital in Palestine, financial inflows to an increasingly self-segregated Jewish economy during the 1920s were 41.5% larger than its net domestic product, an astonishing level. Between 1926 and 1932, the Jewish population ceased to grow as a proportion of the country's population, stagnating at between 17 and 18.5%. Some of these years coincided with the Global Depression, when Jews leaving Palestine outpaced those arriving and capital inflows decreased markedly. At that point, the Zionist project looked as if it might never attain the critical demographic mass that would make Palestine as Jewish as England is English, in Weissman's words. Everything changed in 1933 with the rise to power in Germany of the Nazis, who immediately began to persecute and drive out the well-established Jewish community. With discriminatory immigration laws in place in the United States, the United Kingdom, and other countries, many German Jews had nowhere to go but Palestine. Hitler's ascendancy proved to be one of the most important events in the modern histories of both Palestine and Zionism. In 1935 alone, more than 60,000 Jewish immigrants came to Palestine, a number greater than the entire Jewish population of the country in 1917. Most of these refugees, mainly from Germany, but also from neighboring countries where anti-Semitic persecution was intensifying, were skilled and educated. German Jews were allowed to bring assets worth a total of $100 million, thanks to the transfer agreement reached between the Nazi government and the Zionist movement, concluded in exchange for lifting a Jewish boycott of Germany. During the 1930s, the Jewish economy in Palestine overtook the Arab sector for the first time, and the Jewish population grew to more than 30% of the total by 1939. In light of fast economic growth and this rapid population shift over only 7 years, combined with considerable expansion of the Zionist movement's military capacities, it became clear to its leaders that the demographic, economic, territorial, and military nucleus necessary for achieving domination over the entire country, or most of it, would soon be in place. As Ben-Gurion put it at the time, immigration at the rate of 60,000 a year means a Jewish state in all Palestine. Many Palestinians came to similar conclusions. Palestinians now saw themselves inexorably turning into strangers in their own land, as Isa al-Isa had warned in dire tones in 1929. Over the first 20 years of British occupation, the Palestinians' increasing resistance to the Zionist movement's growing dominance had found expression in periodic outbreaks of violence, which occurred in spite of commitments by the Palestinian leadership to the British to keep their followers in line. In the countryside, sporadic attacks, often described by the British and the Zionists as banditry, bespoke the popular anger at Zionist land purchases, which often resulted in the expulsion of peasants from lands they considered to be theirs that were their source of livelihood. In the cities, demonstrations against British rule and the expansion of the Zionist parastate grew larger and more militant in the early 1930s. Trying to maintain control of events, the elite notables organized the Pan-Islamic Conference while sending several delegations to London and coordinating various forms of protest. These leaders, however unwilling to confront the British too openly, withstood Palestinian calls for a full boycott of the British authorities and a tax strike. They remained unable to see that their timid diplomatic approach could not possibly convince any British government to renounce its commitment to Zionism or to acquiesce in the Palestinians' demands. In consequence, these elite efforts failed to halt the march of the Zionist project or to advance the Palestinian cause in any way. Nevertheless, in response to growing Palestinian agitation, and especially following the outbreaks of violent unrest, different British governments were obliged to re-examine their policies in Palestine. The result was a variety of commissions of inquiry and white papers. These included the Hayward Commission in 1920, the Churchill White Paper in 1922, the Shaw Commission in 1929, the Hope Simpson Report in 1930, the Passfield White Paper in 1930, the Peel Commission in 1937, and the Woodhead Commission in 1938. However, these policy papers recommended only limited measures to placate the Palestinians, most of which were countermanded by the government in London under pressure from the Zionists, or proposed a course of action that only compounded their deep sense of injustice. The eventual result was an unprecedented countrywide violent explosion in Palestine, starting in 1936. The frustration of the Palestinian population at their leadership's ineffective response over 15 years of congresses, demonstrations, and futile meetings with obdurate British officials finally led to a massive grassroots uprising. This started with a 6-month general strike, one of the longest in colonial history, launched spontaneously by groups of young, urban, middle-class militants, many of them members of the Istiqlal Party, all over the country. The strike eventually developed into the great 1936-1939 revolt, which was the crucial event of the interwar period in Palestine. In the 2 decades after 1917, the Palestinians had been unable to develop an overarching framework for their national movement, such as the Wefd in Egypt, or the Congress Party in India, or Sinn Féin in Ireland. Nor did they maintain an apparently solid national front, as some other peoples fighting colonialism had managed to do. Their efforts were undermined by the hierarchical, conservative, and divided nature of Palestinian society and politics, characteristic of many in the region, and further sapped by a sophisticated policy of divide and rule adopted by the mandatory authorities, aided and abetted by the Jewish Agency. This colonial strategy may have reached its peak of perfection in Palestine after hundreds of years of maturation in Ireland, India, and Egypt. The British policies meant to divide the Palestinians included co-opting factions of their elite, setting members of the same family, such as the Husseinis, against one another, and inventing out-of-whole-cloth traditional institutions to serve their purposes. Examples of these British creations were the proposition of Grand Mufti of all Palestine. Traditionally, there had been 4 Muftis of Jerusalem, not all of Palestine. 1 each for the Hanafi, Shafi'i, Maliki, and Hanbali rights, and the Supreme Muslim Council to administer Muslim community affairs. The British had nominated Hajj Amin al-Husseini as Grand Mufti and head of the council after he pledged to Sir Herbert Samuel during a sort of job interview that he would maintain order, which he did for the better part of 15 years. His appointment served 2 purposes. 1 was to create an alternative leadership structure to the nationalist Arab executive of the Palestinian Congresses, which was headed by the Mufti's cousin, Musa Kazim Pasha al-Husseini, and thus also to instigate friction between the 2 men. The other was to enforce the idea that, besides the Jewish people with its national characteristics, the Arab population of Palestine had no national nature and consisted only of religious communities. These measures were meant to distract the Palestinians from demanding democratic, nationwide representative institutions, to divide the national movement, and to prevent the creation of a single national alternative to the mandate and its Zionist charge. Although the tactics of divide and rule were fairly successful until the mid-1930s, the 6-month general strike of 1936 constituted a popular and spontaneous explosion from the bottom up that took the British, the Zionists, and the elite Palestinian leadership by surprise, and that obliged the latter to put aside its divisions, at least nominally. The result was the creation of the Arab Higher Committee, which was set up to lead and represent the entire Arab majority, although the British never recognized the AHC as representative. The committee was made up entirely of men, all people of substance, and all members of the Palestinian elite in its service, landowning and merchant wings. The AHC tried to take charge of the general strike, but unfortunately their most important achievement was to broker an end to it in the fall of 1936 at the request of several Arab rulers. who were essentially acting at the behest of their patrons, the British. They promised the Palestinian leadership that the British would provide redress for their grievances. The disappointing outcome of this intervention came in July 1937, when a royal commission under Lord Peel, charged with investigating the unrest in Palestine, proposed to partition the country, creating a small Jewish state in about 17% of the territory, from which over 200,000 Arabs would be expelled. Expulsion was euphemized as transfer. Under this scheme, the rest of the country was to remain under British control or be handed over to Britain's client, Amir Abdullah of Transjordan, which from a Palestinian perspective amounted to much the same thing. Once again, the Palestinians had been treated as if they had no national existence and no collective rights. The Peel Commission's satisfaction of the basic Zionist aims of statehood and removal of the Palestinians, albeit not in the whole of Palestine, combined with its denial of their fervently desired goal of self-determination, goaded the Palestinians into a much more militant stage of their uprising. The armed revolt that broke out in October 1937 swept the country. It was only brought under control 2 years later through a massive use of force, just in time for crack British military units. By then, there were 100,000 troops in Palestine, one for every 4 adult Palestinian men, to be redeployed to fight World War II. The revolt achieved remarkable temporary successes, but ultimately produced debilitating results for the Palestinians. Of all the services Britain provided to the Zionist movement before 1939, perhaps the most valuable was the armed suppression of Palestinian resistance in the form of the revolt. The bloody war waged against the country's majority, which left 10% of the adult male Arab population killed, wounded, imprisoned, or exiled, was the best illustration of the unvarnished truths uttered by Jabotinsky about the necessity of the use of force for the Zionist project to succeed. To quash the uprising, the British Empire brought in 2 additional divisions of troops, squadrons of bombers, and all the paraphernalia of repression that it had perfected over many decades of colonial wars. The refinements of callousness and cruelty employed went well beyond summary executions. For possession of a single bullet, Sheikh Farhan al-Sa'di, an 81-year-old rebel leader, was put to death in 1937. Under the martial law in force at the time, that single bullet was sufficient to merit capital punishment, particularly for an accomplished guerrilla fighter like al-Sa'di. Well over 100 such sentences of execution were handed down after summary trials by military tribunals, with many more Palestinians executed on the spot by British troops. Infuriated by rebels ambushing their convoys and blowing up their trains, the British resorted to tying Palestinian prisoners to the front of armored cars and locomotives to prevent rebel attack, a tactic they had pioneered in a futile effort to crush resistance of the Irish during their War of Independence from 1919 to 1921. Demolitions of the homes of imprisoned or executed rebels, or of presumed rebels or their relatives, was routine. Another tactic borrowed from the British playbook developed in Ireland. 2 other imperial practices employed extensively in repressing the Palestinians were the detention of thousands without trial and the exile of troublesome leaders. The explosive reaction to the Peel Commission's partition recommendation culminated in the assassination of the British District Commissioner for Galilee, Captain Lewis Andrews, in October 1937. In response to this direct challenge to British authority, the Mandate authorities deported virtually the entire Palestinian nationalist leadership, including the mayor of Jerusalem, Dr. Hussein al-Khaldi, my uncle. With 4 others, he and another 2 were members of the AHC, he was sent to the Seychelles Islands, an isolated location in the Indian Ocean that the British Empire frequently chose for exiling nationalist opponents. The men were held in a heavily guarded compound for 16 months, deprived of visitors and outside contact. Their fellow prisoners in the Seychelles included political leaders from Aden in Yemen and Zanzibar. Other Palestinian leaders were exiled to Kenya or South Africa, while a few, including the Mufti, managed to escape and made their way to Lebanon. Still others were confined, generally without trial, in more than a dozen of what the British themselves called concentration camps, most notably that in Sarafand. Among them was another uncle of mine, Ghalib, who, like his older brother, was involved in nationalist activity deemed to be anti-British. Just before his arrest and exile, Hussein al-Khaldi, who served on the AHC and as Jerusalem's elected mayor for 3 years before he was removed by the British, encountered Major General Sir John Dill, the officer in command of the British forces in Palestine. In his memoirs, my uncle recalls telling the general that the only way to end the violence was to meet some of the Palestinians' demands, specifically stopping Jewish immigration. What would be the effect of arresting the Arab leadership? Dill wanted to know. A senior Arab figure had told him that such arrests would end the revolt in days or weeks. My uncle set him straight. The revolt would only accelerate and spread out of control. It was the Jewish agency that wanted the arrests, and al-Khaldi knew that the colonial office was considering it, but solving the Palestinian question would not be so simple. My uncle had been right. In the months after his exile and the mass arrests of others, the revolt entered its most intense phase, and British forces lost control of several urban areas and much of the countryside, which were taken over and governed by the rebels. In the words of Dill's successor, Lieutenant General Robert Haining, in August 1938, the situation was such that civil administration of the country was, to all practical purposes, non-existent. In December, Haining reported to the War Office that practically every village in the country harbors and supports the rebels and will assist in concealing their identity from the government forces. It took the full might of the British Empire, which could only be unleashed when more troops became available after the Munich Agreement in September 1938, and nearly a year more of fierce fighting to extinguish the Palestinian uprising. Meanwhile, deep differences had appeared among the Palestinians, some aligned with Amir Abdullah of Jordan, quietly welcomed the Peel Commission's recommendation of partition, as it favored attaching to Transjordan the part of Palestine that would not be transformed into the new Jewish state. Most Palestinians, however, strongly opposed all aspects of the recommendations, whether the partition of their country, the establishment in it of a Jewish state, however small, or the expulsion from that state of most of its Arab population. Thereafter, as the revolt reached its height in late 1937 and early 1938, an even more intense internecine conflict among Palestinians followed a bitter split between those loyal to the Mufti, who favored no compromise with the British, and the Mufti's opponents, led by the former Jerusalem mayor, Raghib al-Nashashibi, who were more conciliatory. In the view of Isa al-Isa, inter-Palestinian disputes, which resulted in hundreds of assassinations in the late 1930s, gravely sapped the strength of the Palestinians. He himself was forced into exile to Beirut in 1938 after his life was threatened and his house in Ramallah burned with the loss of all his books and papers. This was undoubtedly the work of the Mufti's men, and it left him deeply bitter. If at the outset the revolt was directed against the English and the Jews, he wrote, it was transformed into a civil war where methods of terrorism, pillage, theft, fire, and murder became common. In spite of the sacrifices made, which can be gauged from the very large numbers of Palestinians who were killed, wounded, jailed, or exiled, and the revolt's momentary success, the consequences for the Palestinians were almost entirely negative. The savage British repression, the death and exile of so many leaders, and the conflict within their ranks left the Palestinians divided, without direction, and with their economy debilitated by the time the revolt was crushed in the summer of 1939. This put the Palestinians in a very weak position to confront the now invigorated Zionist movement, which had gone from strength to strength during the revolt, obtaining lavish amounts of arms and extensive training from the British to help them suppress the uprising. As war clouds loomed in Europe in 1939, however, momentous new global challenges to the British Empire combined with the impact of the Arab revolt to produce a major shift in London's policy, away from its previous full-throated support of Zionism. While the Zionists had been delighted by Britain's decisive smashing of Palestinian resistance, This new shift confronted their leaders with a critical situation. As Europe slid inexorably toward another world war, the British knew that this conflict would be fought, like the previous one, in part on Arab soil. It was now imperative, in terms of core imperial strategic interests, to improve Britain's image and defuse the fury in the Arab countries and the Islamic world at the forcible repression of the Great Revolt, particularly as these areas were being deluged with Axis propaganda about British atrocities in Palestine. A January 1939 report to the cabinet recommending a change of course in Palestine stressed the importance of winning the confidence of Egypt and the neighboring Arab states. The report included a comment from the Secretary of State for India, who said that the Palestine problem is not merely an Arabian problem, but is fast becoming a pan-Islamic problem. He warned that if the problem was not dealt with properly, serious trouble in India must be apprehended. After the failure of a conference held in the spring of 1939 at St. James's Palace in London involving representatives of the Palestinians, the Zionists, and the Arab states, Neville Chamberlain's government issued a white paper in an attempt to appease outraged Palestinian, Arab, and Indian Muslim opinion. This document called for a severe curtailment of Britain's commitment to the Zionist movement. It proposed strict limits on Jewish immigration and on land sales, two major Arab demands, and promised representative institutions in 5 years and self-determination within 10, the most important demands. Although immigration was in fact restricted, none of the other provisions was ever fully implemented. Moreover, representative institutions and self-determination were made contingent on approval of all the parties, which the Jewish agency would never give for an arrangement that would prevent the creation of a Jewish state. The minutes of the cabinet meeting of February 23, 1939, make it clear that Britain meant to withhold the substance of these two crucial concessions from the Palestinians, as the Zionist movement was to have effective veto power, which it would obviously use. The Palestinians might have gained an advantage, albeit a slight one, had they accepted the 1939 white paper, in spite of its flaws from their perspective. Hussein al-Khaldi, for one, did not believe that the British government was sincere in any of its pledges. He stated acidly that he knew at the St. James's Palace Conference, which he was brought out of exile in the Seychelles to attend, that Britain never seriously intended for one moment to be faithful to its promises. From the first sessions, it was clear to him that the conference was a means to gain time and to drug the Arabs, no more and no less, to please the Arabs so they would stop their revolution and give the British time to catch their breath as war clouds gathered. He nevertheless came around to favoring a flexible and positive response to the white paper, as did other Palestinian leaders such as Musa al-Alami and Jamal al-Husseini, the Mufti's cousin. In the end, however, the Mufti, after indicating that he was inclined toward acceptance, insisted on outright refusal, and his position carried the day. After the St. James's Palace Conference, the British once again sent Hussein al-Khaldi into exile, this time to Lebanon. When he saw how the revolt had degenerated in the face of massive British repression and how dire the situation was in Palestine, he argued for halting the resistance. But here, too, his views were overruled. In any case, it was already too late. The Chamberlain government had only a few months left in office when it issued the white paper. Britain was at war very soon afterward, and Winston Churchill, who succeeded Chamberlain as Prime Minister, was perhaps the most ardent Zionist in British public life. More important, as World War II turned into a truly global conflict with the Nazi invasion of the Soviet Union and the entry of the United States into the war after Pearl Harbor, a new world was about to be born in which Britain would at best be a second-class power. The fate of Palestine would no longer be in its hands. But as Dr. Hussein bitterly noted, by this point Britain had already more than done its duty to its Zionist protege. Looking back in his three-volume memoirs written in Beirut in 1949, during one of the many periods of exile he endured, my uncle believed that the primary problem faced by the Palestinians during the Mandate was the British. He deplored the bad faith and ineptitude of the leaders of the Arab states, and he directed balanced and mostly even-keeled criticism at the failures of the Palestinian leadership, including at times his own. He saw clearly the impact of the Zionist movement's single-minded focus on complete domination of Palestine and the competence and sheer deceitful audacity of its leaders, many of whom he knew personally. But, like most of his generation and class, Dr. Hussein reserved his true spleen for the British and their hostility toward the Palestinians. He knew many of their officials well. He had served as a senior medical officer under the Mandate administration before becoming mayor of Jerusalem. He later dealt with them as a negotiator at the St. James's Palace Conference in 1939, and then in Jerusalem through the fighting of 1947 and 48, when he was one of the few Palestinian leaders to remain in the Holy City. Many were still in British-ordered exile. He apparently got on with a few British officials, and the English he had learned at the Anglican St. George's School in Jerusalem and the American University of Beirut served him well in his dealings with them. But his resentment of the hypocrisy, haughtiness, and duplicity of British officialdom in general was boundless. He took T.E. Lawrence of Arabia as a perfect example of British perfidy. Although he was careful to contrast Lawrence's frank description in Seven Pillars of Wisdom of his deception and betrayals of the Arabs with the honesty and uprightness of the British teachers and missionaries he knew in Jerusalem before the war. It was their consistent support for the Zionists that most angered Dr. Hussein. Even if British officials in Palestine became convinced of the unsustainable manifold costs of maintaining the Iron Wall to protect the Zionist project, whose leaders were often ungrateful for all that was done for them, their recommendations were almost invariably countermanded in London. At least until 1939, the Zionists were able to place their supporters, or sometimes their leaders, like the formidable Chaim Weizmann, at the elbow of key British decision-makers in Whitehall, some of whom were also fervent Zionists. Dr. Hussein notes caustically that when official British commissions came out to Palestine to investigate the situation in the 1920s and 1930s, any conclusions they reached that were favorable to the Arabs were countered by Zionist lobbying in London, where an extraordinary degree of intimacy prevailed between Zionist leaders and senior British political figures. Isa al-Isa also wrote his memoirs in exile in Beirut soon after the 1948 war. His view of the interwar period differs in many respects from my uncle's. Unlike Dr. Hussein, al-Isa had fallen out bitterly with the Mufti after the Peel Commission report in 1937, and he suffered personally from the subsequent split in the Palestinian leadership. If, in al-Isa's view, this internal division gravely harmed the Palestinians, so did backward social relations and lack of education among the Arabs, and above all, the unwavering focus of the Zionists, backed by the British, on supplanting the indigenous population, a topic on which he had been writing eloquently for many decades. He had no love for the British, nor they for him, but in his analysis, the central problem was Zionism, compounded by Palestinian and Arab weakness. Fittingly, his critiques in poetry and prose of the Arab rulers after 1948 were scathing, and his descriptions of them, especially Amir Abdullah, are far from complimentary. Two further things must be said in conclusion about the revolt and about Britain's repression of it. The first is that it proved the clear-sightedness of Ze'ev Jabotinsky and the self-delusion of many British officials. The Zionists' colonial enterprise, aimed at taking over the country, necessarily had to produce resistance. "If you wish to colonize a land in which people are already living," Jabotinsky wrote in 1925, "you must find a garrison for the land, or find a benefactor who will provide a garrison on your behalf. Zionism is a colonizing venture, and therefore it stands or falls on the question of armed forces." At least initially, only the armed forces provided by Britain could overcome the natural resistance of those being colonized. Much earlier, the King Crane Commission, sent out in 1919 by President Woodrow Wilson to ascertain the wishes of the peoples of the region, had come to similar conclusions as those of Jabotinsky. told by representatives of the Zionist movement that it looked forward to a practically complete dispossession of the present non-Jewish inhabitants of Palestine in the course of turning Palestine into a Jewish state. The commissioners reported that none of the military experts they consulted believed that the Zionist program could be carried out except by force of arms, and all considered that a force of not less than 50,000 soldiers would be required to execute this program. In the end, it took the British more than double that number of troops to prevail over the Palestinians in 1936 through 1939. In a cover letter to Wilson, the commissioners presciently warned that if the American government decided to support the establishment of a Jewish state in Palestine, they are committing the American people to the use of force in that area, since only by force can a Jewish state in Palestine be established or maintained. The commission thereby accurately predicted the course of the subsequent century. The second point is that both the revolt and its repression, and the consequent successful implantation of the Zionist project, were the direct, inevitable results of the policies set out in the Balfour Declaration, and the belated implementation of the declaration of war that Balfour's words embodied. Balfour did not think that Zionism will hurt the Arabs, and initially seemed to believe there would be no significant reaction to the Zionists taking over their country. But in the words of George Orwell, sooner or later, a false belief bumps up against solid reality, usually on a battlefield, which is precisely what happened on the battlefield in the Great Revolt, to the Palestinians' lasting detriment. After 1917, the Palestinians found themselves in a triple bind, which may have been unique in the history of resistance to colonial settler movements. Unlike most other peoples who fell under colonial rule, they not only had to contend with the colonial power in the metropole, in this case London, but also with a single colonial settler movement that, while beholden to Britain, was independent of it, had its own national mission, a seductive biblical justification, and an established international base and financing. According to the British official responsible for migration and statistics, the British government was not the colonizing power here. The Jewish people are the colonizing power. Making matters worse was that Britain did not rule Palestine outright. It did so as a mandatory power of the League of Nations. It was therefore bound not just by the Balfour Declaration, but also by the international commitment embodied in the 1922 mandate for Palestine. Time and time again, expressions of deep Palestinian dissatisfaction in the form of protests and disturbances caused British administrators on the spot and in London to recommend modifications in policy. However, Palestine was not a crown colony or any other form of colonial possession, where the British government was free to act as it pleased. If it appeared that Palestinian pressure might force Britain to violate the letter or the spirit of the mandate, there was intensive lobbying in the League's Permanent Mandates Commission in Geneva to remind it of its overarching obligations to the Zionists. Thanks to Britain's faithfulness to these obligations, by the end of the 1930s, it was too late to reverse the transformation of the country or to change the lopsided balance of forces that had developed between the two sides. The great initial disadvantage under which the Palestinians labored was compounded by the Zionist organization's massive capital investments, arduous labor, sophisticated legal maneuvers, intensive lobbying, effective propaganda, and covert and overt military means. The Jewish colonists' armed units had developed semi-clandestinely until the British allowed the Zionist movement to operate military formations openly in the face of the Arab revolt. At this point, the Jewish agency's collusion with the mandatory authorities reached its peak. There is a consensus among objective historians that this collusion, supported by the League of Nations, severely undermined any possibility of success for the Palestinian struggle for the representative institutions, self-determination, and independence they believed were their right. What the Palestinians might have done to get out of this triple bind is an impossible question to answer. Some have argued that they should have abandoned the preferred legalistic approach of their conservative leadership of mounting empty protests and fruitlessly sending delegations to London to appeal to British goodwill and fair-mindedness. Instead, this thesis suggests they should have broken completely with the British, refused to cooperate with the mandate, as had the Congress Party with the Raj in India or Sinn Féin with the British in Ireland. And failing all else, they should have followed the path of their Arab neighbors and risen up in arms much sooner than they ultimately did. In any case, they had very few good choices in the face of the powerful triad of Britain, the Zionist movement, and the League of Nations mandate. Moreover, they had no serious allies, besides the support of amorphous, incohate Arab public opinion, which was solidly behind them, even before 1914, but all the more so as the interwar period wore on. No Arab country, except Saudi Arabia and Yemen, however, enjoyed full independence. Indeed, all of them were largely still under the thumb of the British and the French. And none had fully democratic institutions, such that this pro-Palestinian opinion could express itself fully. When the British left Palestine in 1948, there was no need to create the apparatus of a Jewish state ab novo. That apparatus had in fact been functioning under the British aegis for decades. All that remained to make Herzl's prescient dream a reality was for this existing parastate to flex its military muscle against the weakened Palestinians while obtaining formal sovereignty, which it did in May 1948. The fate of Palestine had thus been decided 30 years earlier, although the denouement did not come until the very end of the mandate, when its Arab majority was finally dispossessed by force.